Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm Carla Nappi, your host. I just finished talking with Per Castle about his wonderful new book, Grounds of Judgment, Extraterritoriality and Imperial Power in 19th Century China and Japan, and that's hot off the presses with Oxford University Press in 2012. Now, this is a book that is focused on a very rich and very deep case study in the context of transnational 19th century history, but it's also a book that, as you'll hear from the following conversation, has very wide-ranging implications for the way we think about and practice multi-sided and transnational or sort of transnational or international history on a local scale. It's a book that includes not just very helpful discussions and very provocative questions about what it means to talk about the law, what it means to enact the law, and understanding that that's not a unitary, monosemic concept in different places and times, but it also includes some fascinating and really amusing and very educational case studies, including the opening account of a Swedish businessman who publishes an announcement in the North China Daily News, through to homicide cases, forgery cases, cases of sort of international murder when somebody farts in the wrong place at the wrong time. And we didn't talk about that in the interview, but that's something that you'll get when you actually pick up and read the book. It's a wonderful book. We had a great time talking, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, Per.
Hello.
We're here today at New Books in East Asian Studies to talk with Per Castle about his recent book, Grounds of Judgment, Extraterritoriality and Imperial Power in 19th Century China and Japan. Now, this is not only a study of a very crucial period and phenomenon in global history. So this is relevant to not just East Asia, but really global history, as we'll talk about later on in our conversation. But it's also very methodologically interesting. So I'm really thrilled to talk with you today, Per. Welcome, and thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you too.
Could you start us off by saying just something, just a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to this field and to this topic in particular?
Well, first of all, I'm born and educated in Sweden. That's where I started to study Chinese first. And then my interest in language and history brought me first to China, then to Japan, and then later to graduate school in the United States. And it was really in graduate school about 12 years ago that my sort of interest in combining language, combining the findings of New Qing history, and combining the recent gains, I would say, in legal study into some kind of study of the treaty ports, which is something that has always fascinated me. And another motive was also that I wanted to bring Japan into the narrative of the treaty ports and extraterritoriality, because usually when you look at the literature on extraterritoriality and the so-called unequal treaties, it's either China versus the West or Japan versus the West or China versus Japan. And very few studies have tried to sort of integrate these three areas into some kind of triangular relationship. So those were the kind of impulses that I started on when I formulated my dissertation topic that later went into this book.
Great. And as we'll get to, I hope, later on in our conversation, and I'll just mention for our listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, though I hope they will after listening if they haven't already, one of the things that the book does really exceptionally well is sets up an argument for thinking about 19th century history of East Asia, not just in a kind of teleological context of reading back from the current boundaries of nation states into the 19th century, right? But by situating it in a longer diachronic narrative localized in the Qing and earlier and Japan and earlier. So it's, I think it does that really effectively, and that's something that I think we'll talk about. So, Per, this is a first book for you, and congratulations. I know it came out very recently. Can you talk a little bit, for the benefit of our listeners, about the transformation in going from the dissertation to the book? Were there any major transformations? What was the process like for you?
Well, there are a number of things that you need to do to go from a dissertation to a book. Usually when you write a dissertation, it is to, well, first of all, for your committee, and then also for your peers in the field, people that are interested and very kind of read in on the topic to understand your argument and to see what sources you bring, what new kind of arguments and methodologies you bring to the table. And it's usually the challenge will be, first of all, the gaps. There are always things that you need to do more research. I had to go to the National Archives in the United Kingdom. There are also transformations where you will have to articulate your own argument. And that was one process that I went through with my editor, where she was repeatedly asking me, well, you know, this is what, you know, your secondary source says. Is that really necessary to include that in your book? Can you rephrase that in your own words? And when you do that, when you rephrase someone else's argument with your own words in contact with your own primary sources and your own argument, then things start to happen. And in my case, things that I started to think about on in general was questions of nation building. What role does citizenship and subjecthood play in nation building, and what is the relationship between that and extraterritoriality? And we will, of course, talk about that in more detail later. What is the nature of law in China? When we use the word law in the West, does it really cover the same area as we would think in the Chinese case? And also broader questions, what is a foreigner? What is a foreigner in China? Who is a foreigner? When does a foreigner become Chinese? Is it racial? Is it questions of certain ritual types of behavior? Of course, many of these questions came along the writing process, and I kind of sometimes just rewrote a paragraph and felt that perhaps that's a paper at the next conference, or that's an article, or perhaps a new project. So this is the kind of the trajectory you go through. And then, of course, when you write a book, you will have to make sure that it ends where it begins, that you really deliver on what you set out to give the readers and set up very, very early. You have basically 2 or 3 pages in a book manuscript to capture the imagination of the reader and then introduce him to something that you think is interesting, and hopefully the reader will find interesting, and then establish the major themes very clearly, very explicitly. And then at the end, you will have to wrap that up and give a kind of pointers where you want to go in the future. And in so doing, you will rethink things that you thought that you had very firm ideas about in the beginning of writing the book. So I would say that some of the chapters are quite radically rewritten. Others are adapted to the kind of the framework as set up in the sort of writing of an introduction and conclusion.
Now, you mentioned something really interesting in the acknowledgments, and I wanted to ask you about this, mostly for the benefit of junior faculty. And I read this and thought, wow, that's a great idea. And I don't know if I'm interpreting it correctly, so I'm going to ask you. You mentioned in the acknowledgments that there was a manuscript workshop in 2009. What was that? And can you describe what that was for our listeners? Because in my mind, I'm imagining a workshop that's devoted to you and your manuscript. Is that the case? And if so, how did you work that out? Because I think that's a fantastic idea, if that is, in fact, what you meant by a manuscript workshop.
You're correct. That is exactly what happened. And it's part of the kind of departmental culture of the history department at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor to provide junior faculty on the tenure track with an opportunity to discuss their book manuscript in whatever gestational stage it's in, together with 2 invited colleagues that are invited and flown in. And then it's an afternoon where these 2 external readers, but they're there in person, so you know who they are, and usually you ask for you know, who would you would like to come, and they will go through your book. They will sometimes present criticism or points in writing, and then usually after that, they've done that. The floor opens for a discussion with interested faculty, and it can take many different formats. The workshop is set up with you. With the chair, you know, in consultation with the chair of the department, and all faculty members that I've been with in Michigan in my same kind of career track have done the same. And it's usually then when, you know, the book title comes up or you realize, wow, you know, I'm dancing around this topic, I perhaps should address this much more closely. But it's also an occasion for you sometimes to stand your ground and explain to people what the book is about and what it's not about. And it's kind of a, you know, a second defense or a preparation for other types of reviews that you will go through. So yes, you're correct in interpreting this as, in understanding this as a workshop organized by the department for junior faculty.
What a fantastic idea. I just wanted to mention that because three cheers for University of Michigan for your department for implementing that. I wish everybody had the opportunity to do that. That's just absolutely fantastic. So, okay, now that I'm done I'm going on about how wonderful that is, let's get into the book itself, which is a fantastic book. And it just, like I said, it has, I think, many wide-ranging implications, both for your field and also well beyond it. So first things first, let's start at the very beginning. This is a book about the history of extraterritoriality, among other things. So for listeners who may not have ever heard that word or understand why that's important to 19th century history, can you briefly explain that concept? What is extraterritoriality, and why is it important? Why should we care about that as historians of this period and beyond?
Well, extraterritoriality, in brief, is the projection of one jurisdiction's laws, is the projection of the laws of one country and the procedures of one country into the territory of another country through people. So, for instance, if an American in 19th century China committed a crime or was sued in a lawsuit, he could only be answerable to his own authorities. That would be the American Consul General, or it would be a consular judge. And what this implied was that the law followed the person rather than the law followed the territory. So when you crossed a territory, it didn't necessarily mean that you were under a different sort of jurisdiction and another system of law. And on paper, of course, this principle is very simple. It is often called, it's often a consequence of what we call personal jurisdiction, that the law follows the person rather than the territory. But on paper, in reality, this is far more complex, because if you have a country like China, that in the 1840s, 50s through the 60s concluded treaties with, you know, a dozen countries, all having their own formulation of extraterritoriality, it became very complex, because these treaties not only regulated the relationship between the Chinese and foreigners from various countries, but also the relationship between foreigners on Chinese soil. And as long as, extraterritorial people following the laws of another country live in restricted areas called treaty ports, usually these things can be resolved ad hoc. But as, you know, China's interaction with the rest of the world became more intense, and Chinese politicians and Chinese statesmakers and intellectuals wanted to build a nation state with one sole body of law governing all people in the territories that they claimed for China, this, of course, became a problem and an obstacle in nation building. And that is why we should care about this, because every time you, for instance, talk about any type of law that would have consequences within the borders of China, say international law, human rights legislation, or copyright law, even civil law up to a certain extent, These things actually resonates against this experience of extraterritoriality. And the very word extraterritoriality just means something that's beyond the territory, beyond the territory. And it's a word that came into use rather late in the game. So did that explain your question, or do you want more precise formulation?
Oh, that's great. No, that's wonderful. And I think the because in some ways the whole body of the book looks at and follows through the different ways that this seemingly simple concept, right, plays out in very complicated ways. I think we'll also expand on this in the remaining time, but that's great. Now, the argument here is going to be, and we'll get to this, at least in part, that China and Japan had very different experiences in abolishing extraterritoriality in the 19th century. And so we'll get to this in time. Now, one of the things that I want to ask you about, you've already mentioned in our brief discussion so far, and you also mentioned at one point late in the book, that your perspective is informed by something that's often referred to as the New Qing History. Can you talk for us a little bit about the ways that this approach to Qing history has shaped the way you wrote the book and the way you understand these issues?
Well, New Qing History was I think it was coined by Joanna Whaley Cohen. I also think that Kent Guy wrote a review article where he mentioned that word roughly around the year 2000. And it was it's a term that people today are a little bit reluctant to use, but what it used to mean was the scholarship that emanated from the insight that the Qing Empire, as we now prefer to call China before 1912, that the Qing Empire was a multi-ethnic empire, that it was an empire which had a number of different polities, different legal systems in force, and that the fact that the ruling elite of the Qing Empire was mainly Manchu, partially Mongol, and also a certain group of Chinese in the banner system. And the fact that the banner system and the Manchus existed does matter to the way we should understand Chinese history, and that we should be very careful, for instance, in thinking that that Tibet or Xinjiang or Mongolia are related to Beijing or related to the rest of the sort of Han Chinese lands of China in the same way as they do today. And that is one of the major insights of New Qing history, I would argue. And also, as a consequence of that, the languages you will have to use to approach New Qing history will be more than just Chinese or the type of Qing, kind of administrative Chinese that we're taught in graduate school. You may have to learn Manchu or at least be conversant in Manchu. You may have to understand how Mongol or Tibetan works. I would argue that perhaps English, French, Russian, Japanese are also part of that concept, if we accept the idea of Jonkin Fairbanks that the Qing Empire after the 1860s was kind of run as a joint venture between Manchus, Chinese statesmen, and foreign diplomats. So it's a kind of a calling into question what China actually is, to what extent China today is just a successor of the Qing Empire. And once you start to ask those questions, things like extraterritoriality, things like the treaty ports, a number of institutions don't look the same as they do when you assume that the present People's Republic of China or the Republic of China earlier is the only natural outcome of this very rich culturally rich and complex Qing Empire.
Thank you. Now, you mentioned later on in the book, and we'll get to this, that the Treaty of Tianjin, one of the many treaties that the book chronicles the development and operation or lack thereof of, between the Qing and Romanov empires was the last treaty to have a Manchu language version. Because you also bring up Manchu elsewhere in the book, can you talk a little bit about, coming from your comments on the New Qing history, the importance of Manchu language sources to your work in this book in particular. Did you find that they were important for this history? Did they change anything? Did you find yourself working with Manchu sources very much for this, or was it not a body of material that was central, or how did that work? So Manchu language.
Well, the Manchu language is one of those, it became one of my obsessions in my first year in graduate school when I started to study it under Mark Elliott and Jim Bolson. Manchu, I think any person doing Qing history should learn Manchu, because even if you don't use sources in Manchu, it will actually change your thinking and the way you look at the Qing Empire. But in my case, Manchu was mainly used. I mainly used Manchu for understanding treaties. I did read the Treaty of Nerchinsk, the Treaty of Kiachta in the original Manchu version in graduate school. I also did take a look at paragraphs when there was a Chinese and a Manchu version, or a Chinese and Manchu and a Russian version, and compared the terminology. This was useful because, for instance, certain terms that are of importance in the book, for instance, li shi, which just means to manage business in Chinese, In the Manchu version, within the context of a judicial sub-prefect, as I call it, is called wei le beidere. That means the crime punishing or the crime trying sub-prefect. And then the Manchu often brings out more kind of clarity in that sense, that the Manchu sometimes have to make things more explicit. So it was mainly in terms of understanding treaties and sometimes question certain assumptions about how people have understood the treaty. One example of that is the interpretation by a prominent Chinese legal scholar, Wellington Guo, or Gui Jun, who made a very strong argument that in order to understand the Treaty of Kiachta, you have to have read the Chinese version. The problem with that argument was that there was no Chinese version of the Treaty of Kiachta in 1727. There was a Manchu version, there was a Russian version, and I think a Latin version. And all other subsequent iterations of that treatise have been translations, very good translations, but they were not done, informed by translation theory. So there were gaps and slippages, and I kind of corrected some of those assumptions that he made when it came to the trial of people who had absconded across the Russian Chinese or the Romanov Empire, Qing Empire sort of borders.
Now, this actually brings up an issue that I wanted to mention, and that's something that I think makes the book, even if the title doesn't seem like it would explicitly indicate this, I think the book is of profound interest to people interested in translation studies, because one of the points, again, stemming from what you just told us, I think very helpfully about Manchu and Manchu language sources, one of the points that's consistently raised in the book is the importance of language and terminology, right? Specifically, the importance of legal and political terms in the context of treaties, and also the importance of translation or sort of interpretation of terminology as a medium of legal reform. I mean, this is actually, I was pleasantly, because I'm interested in translation, but I was very surprised as I read through the book how often this set of issues is really foundational to the history of diplomacy in this period and of extraterritoriality in particular.
Yeah, I mean, that brings in the relevance of Chinese into the study of extraterritoriality, because if you go back and do a search, a WebCat search on extraterritoriality in China, most of the books that you will find are in English, French, or German, and most of the books that you will find in Chinese will use those very books in European languages to make very kind of high-stakes argument about the nature of the system. So in a sense, they're perpetuating Western assumptions of superiority in China. And what happened to me when I went into the archives, especially when I went to the diplomatic records office in Tokyo, was that I found that almost all correspondence between Qing diplomats and Japanese diplomats, whether it be in China or in Japan, was in classical Chinese. And of course, administrative Chinese is its own special kind of dialect or sociolect of the Chinese language, where every word has a definite meaning, and the type of classical Japanese that the Japanese are using is its own dialect too. And many of sort of words that we assume came into existence after, you know, got this wave of translation coming back to China after the Sino-Japanese War in 1895. Many of those terms did not exist. So, for instance, when a Chinese would say extraterritoriality, he would not use the word that we have imported from Chinese, Chiwai Fatran, or Qinghai Hokan. He would use the word Bugui Guangxia, which means not under jurisdiction. And I could go at great length explaining why this matters, but suffice it to say is that the Japanese did not always understand what the Chinese meant by their terms, and the Chinese were sometimes scornful of these neologisms. And the reason why this is important is that if we think of the defeat of the Qing Empire in 1895 as a foregone conclusion, then of course this is just a parenthesis about, and something that we could forget about. But people at the time did not know that. They were informed by their own understandings of their own legal system, of how to try inter-ethnic cases, how to understand law, how to invoke law when it was unclear which body of law that should be used. And many of these things hinge on terminology. And I had sensed a certain dissatisfaction when I had read otherwise very good books on the treaty ports that seemed to assume that English, enter Sir Harry Parkes and all the other British, consuls, when they enter into the picture, the English language reigns supreme. Well, perhaps in the newspapers in the treaty ports, but certainly not among officials. And for British officials to be able to make an argument to Chinese officials, they had to use Chinese. So if we don't understand what the terms mean, if we don't understand the context in which they're used, if we don't understand the afterlife of those terms, many of them still exist, how can we understand the Chinese legal system, and how can we understand the contact, the interface between the Chinese legal system and the foreign legal system, which extraterritoriality actually constitutes?
Yeah, this actually gets us to some, it gets us further into the book, and it gets us to some really interesting aspects of the work, issues of sources in particular, and such as the importance of press accounts and of legal documents to the work, and also in a related fashion, the significance of case studies that emerge from these documents as forms of evidence. So I want to, if you don't mind, ask you about these briefly in turn. Can you talk about first the role of newspapers and press sources for the book? And I ask you this because this seems to be a significant aspect of the argument later on in terms of the rise of the popular press and the relationship of international communities, right, in China to the press seems to have significantly impacted the story. So this isn't just a matter of, I read all these press accounts and got a different perspective. It really seems that the nature of this as a material source really helped shape the story that you're telling later on. So would you mind talking about that for a little bit?
Well, that's a very good question, actually. It's the first time someone asked that question about the use of the press at two different levels. I mean, first of all, like many China historians or China-Japan historians, you're a little bit reluctant to use English language sources from the time of the treaty ports, North China Herald and North China Daily News, because they're kind of colonial and they are sort of informed by the kind of the Shanghai Lander mind. And it was rather late, actually, into the work of my dissertation I started to look at them, and I discovered first that they are full of translations of Chinese documents that no longer exist. And many of the people that translated and wrote these accounts were very well informed about what was going on in the Chinese-speaking world. Many of them read Shen Bao, the major Chinese language newspapers. Many of them read the Peking Gazette. So the English language press and the Japanese and the Chinese street reports are kind of communicating vessels with the Chinese and the Japanese language press in a way that I had not expected. And of course, if we read Barbara Mittler's book on Shen Bao, that is, of course, a trajectory or a line of argument that she explores further. So I realized that this was a gold mine to sometimes cross-check accounts, because you would sometimes have a Chinese partisan account of a legal case, then you would have a Japanese partisan account of a legal case, and then you would have an English language account. And by looking at how they describe what happened, how they use legal concepts, how they invoke international law, you could get a more nuanced, I wouldn't say a fuller picture, because it's a little bit like a Rashomon complex at play, but they're much richer than I'd expected. And one thing, just as a parenthesis, I went to Shanghai this summer, and I sat down in the Zikave library in Shijiahui and looked at these things in you know, the read paper version. And I discovered that it seems that the treaty port press in the 19th century was much more informed about Chinese affairs than in the 1920s and the 1930s. You would find extensive tech, like use of Chinese characters in the text itself, and they seem to have employ much more sinologists in the 19th century than in the 20s and the 30s. So that's at one level. Then the second level is, of course, the fact that the press is, of course, never neutral. It always is pushing its own agenda. It's not necessarily a national agenda. It's about selling newspapers and sustaining public interest in the story. And one thing that struck me was that the extent to which the press, for instance, in Japan, has shaped our understanding of extraterritorial cases. There are a number of landmark cases that took place in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s that shaped the Japanese understanding of the unequal treaties, and has become almost folklore. Of abuse of consular jurisdiction. And then I was looking at the Chinese press. There was, you know, tons of even worse cases that never have seemed to have carried the same kind of weight, or have, you know, the more or less kind of local events. When you have steamboat accidents and murder cases that I relate, that don't seem to have attracted interest outside of the treaty ports. And what it seems to be at play here is the role of the press in Japan is shaping a kind of a national audience, and extraterritoriality being, in a sense, a soft target for nation building, because it involves law, it doesn't involve building schools or warships. And in China in the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s, although people certainly did mind foreigners going rampage, protected by privileges, the issue didn't have the same resonance in the press. And that made me start to think about, you know, like how careful we have to be using these sources for making any larger arguments about nationalism and the shaping of public opinion. So did that answer your question? Or?
Absolutely. And it's a great example of what I was mentioning before when I said that this book has, I think, wide-ranging implications for how we think about historical methodology, not just for the content. And along those lines, you just mentioned law. So I want to just ask you briefly about another set of sources that emerged as, at least from the perspective of a reader, is central here. Now, one of the arguments that you make early on is that even the actors in your story had to engage in reading documents that could be very, very intricate and complex. These are legal texts, in order to engage in contemporary debates about extraterritoriality. So I'd love to hear a little bit about your own use of legal cases and documents. Sort of how did your reading of these documents impact your sort of the story that you were telling, and how did you encounter these kinds of documents? Where did you find them, and how did you find reading them for this purpose?
Well, the easiest part, I think, is learning to read them like on a purely sort of technical level. I mean, as long as they're not written, they're not handwritten. I mean, there are in Japan extensive holdings of cases that are microfilmed with Chinese and Japanese. In China, there are fewer of them, or they're less accessible, but they're also published. Sources that you can use, and there are manuals, so it's in that sense a relatively open terrain. The problem, of course, is when you know if you only study Chinese law, or Qing law, as I would prefer to call it, on its own terms. Then, of course, as long as because everybody knows what they're talking about, there are certain silences, there are certain things that are assumed that will never be articulated, but. When you have a conflict of jurisdiction, when you have, say for instance, a Japanese policeman arresting a Chinese and killing him in the action for using opium, then, of course, both the Chinese community and the Qing consul and the Japanese authorities have to go back to the treaty that they signed very hastily a decade earlier and figure out, okay, was a crime committed under what law? Was the Japanese police officer, exercising his duties, or was he infringing on the privileges of a Chinese national in his home? So they have to articulate on the basis of the treaty what they actually mean. And that's where things become tricky, because a lot of things that we assume are self-evident are not self-evident. For instance, most of the treaties that you read would say that if a person from country A commits a crime against a person from country B, he will be tried according to his own laws. Well, what is a crime then? Is it, like for instance, are crimes something that would be that is criminal in your own country? But not criminal in the host country, or things that are criminal in the host country, but not your own country. How do you deal with those things? And the treaties are silent on that point. What they seem to suggest, and what people came to the conclusion, was that you were still subject to the laws of the countries where you lived, even if you had extraterritorial privileges, but you were supposed to be punished in the mode of your own laws by your own officials. So it didn't give you a license to kill or a license to drive on the wrong side of the road or, shooting firearms in the countryside and all these kind of things. But still, there was a tremendous sense of indeterminacy behind extraterritoriality, and it didn't always benefit the people it was supposed to benefit. So what you see in the case record is that every time you have like a court record, if you read in North China Daily Herald, the first thing they would do is to dispute the jurisdiction of the court. And they would say, no, under this paragraph in this treaty, this case has to be tried in the consular court of that country because they have an interest in this case. And I sort of suggest that we resume the proceedings in that consular court. So there's a tremendous sense of indeterminacy of law. This is not helped by the fact that China and Japan are going in very different directions. China does not start really seriously to reform or sort of adapt its legal system to Western models until the 1890s, whereas Japan starts, from the late 1870s, early 1880s to reformulate their system. So the very content of, say, criminal procedure or criminal law, the very content of what is supposed to be regulated by the treaties is a moving target. So consular jurisdiction in 1870 is not the same thing as consular jurisdiction in 1880 or in 1890. And people are painfully aware of that. And there are a number of cases, I think I cited about at least once or twice in the book, where people say, we don't really know what type of legal privileges the Chinese community in Japan have. And certainly not, they don't have the same privileges as Westerners. So that opens a number of questions. What is actually law? I mean, is law what people make up on the spot and enforce in court, or is it something, more transcendent than that?
Thank you so much. Now, this actually, you're talking about the distinctions and the differences between what's happening in China and Japan gets us to into the rest of the book. And in particular, the first chapter does something that the book is very notable in doing, and that is it has an explicitly transregional and transnational focus. Now, what this chapter does is it charts a history of legal pluralism in China and Japan. And for simplicity, I'm seeing China and Japan here. And this is, I won't go into detail except to say that what legal pluralism means is very complicated, and you go into quite a bit of detail in the book in explicating the juristic and social senses of that and talking readers through what that means. Now, you look at Qing China and also Tokugawa and Meiji Japan in this chapter. Can you talk about the ways, looking specifically at the Qing context, that the banner system shaped legal pluralism in the Qing? Because this seems to have been really crucial for what comes later and gets to an important distinction that, or an important phenomenon that recurs throughout the book, even into the last chapter, and that is the way that Manchu and Han identities were negotiated. So the banner system, how was that important and how did that shape legal pluralism in the Qing?
The Manchus in China and of course the allies in the banner, in the eight banners, the Chinese, Mongol, and Han Chinese bannermen, they were under their own jurisdiction. They were living in segregated residential areas, and they could only be tried by officials from the banner system itself. And in every case, there was a criminal suit or a legal suit between a bannerman and a civilian, or a Manchu or a Chinese, if you want to simplify a bit. That had to be trialed by a civil official and a judicial official, sort of in a mixed proceeding. And this, of course, was only one way you would have legal pluralism in China. You would have other types of mixed jurisdictions in Mongolia and Xinjiang and Tibet. But what I wanted to say is that already prior to the entry of foreigners into China, you do have a much more fragmented legal system than people usually would admit there was. And, you know, When you have to sort of integrate or deal with this thing called extraterritoriality, you basically have two choices. One is to add a new layer to the already existing system of legal pluralism, where you have different ethnic and social groups under different jurisdictions and often under different laws. The other alternative is, of course, to reform and create a uniform citizenship within your own country, to abolish all kind of internal distinctions, and then in so doing, making the distinction between foreigner and citizen sort of ridiculous and an impediment for nation building. And from the point of view of Qing statesmen, you know, as much as they did not like foreigners in the treaty ports and they did not like the system itself, for them to mobilize against extraterritoriality would require a renegotiation of the relationship between ruler and ruled, between Manchu and Chinese. And they were certainly not in a point that they could afford to do that in the 1860s and the 1870s, just after the Taiping War. And it's not until the late 1890s, early 1900s, when first you have the, at least so it seemed, a successful Japanese model showing that by creating a unified citizenship and a kind of a uniform body of laws would make it possible to get rid of extraterritoriality. It was not until then they start to address the need of legal reform. And it's not a coincidence that, you know, in the petitions that people sort of outline or chart out the trajectory of legal reform, one of the first things they had to deal with was the distinction between Manchus and Chinese. And they even make a statement in one of these memorials that in order to complete constitutional reform, we need to make Manchus and Han equal. And constitutional reform in, say, 1905, that's code for treaty revision, because that's what it's really all about.
Thank you so much. Now, you make a point here in this chapter, and I mention it because this is going to be important later on as well in the book, in contrasting this with the situation in the Tokugawa and then the Meiji. So how, briefly if you can, how did the Tokugawa and later the Meiji legal situation differ in broad strokes from what we see happening in the Qing case?
I mean, initially, the Tokugawa response to the Qing is not that different from the Qing. I mean, they assume that extraterritoriality means foreigners living in segregated areas where you minimize contact with the local population and where, you know, consular courts cases or mixed court cases are tried ad hoc. Then, of course, one of the reasons that the Tokugawa shogunate falls only a decade or so after the conclusion of the first treatise is that the kind of the foreign relations was one of the raison d'êtres of the Tokugawa shogunate, and their inability to restrain these treaties became undermined the very idea of the shogun being this sort of the first among equals among the feudal lords, and when sovereignty, or at least formal sovereignty, was transferred to the emperor, and a nation state was created, and the Japanese started to abolish the status system. They started to abolish, you know, the samurai as a class, and transformed them into a modern nobility. Then extraterritoriality became an impediment for a unified nation state, which is, you know, the model, what, you know, that was what you did in the 1870s, 1880s, you created unified nation states. So it's really a question of different trajectories, and also the fact that Japan undergoes a very drastic regime change in the 1860s, which China does not, and in so doing, and you could in one, you can turn the tables a little bit in saying that the Tokugawa state failed and the Qing state succeeded in surviving the treaty ports much longer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Now we move from this background, which is, again, going to, for listeners, going to become important. We're going to continue to be important later on because, in fact, one of the arguments here is that is going to be that Qing officials, in part, worked from and adapted long-standing legal concepts from this earlier history and helping establish the kinds of courts and technologies of negotiating extraterritoriality that come later. Now, the next two chapters focus on the Qing and chart the evolution of jurisdictions over foreigners from the late 19th century through the Sino-British Chefoo Convention of 1876, and sort of looks at unequal treaties, the importance of Lin Zexu and opium as a turning point, and the emergence of a most favored nation clause in treaties that will again continue to be important later on throughout this history. Now, the chapter 3 looks in particular at two courts in Shanghai, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about this. Now, one of the kinds of courts that you talk about is the idea of a mixed court. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the idea of a mixed court, and the reason is one of the really surprising things that comes out later on in the book is that even though we're talking about the Qing here and the Qing looking to models for mixed courts, what we'll see later on is that Japan, when it's looking to come up with its own idea of mixed courts, is looking to Egypt for a model of how they might reform the system, which is really fascinating. I think for a lot of readers, this establishing this link between Japan and Egypt is going to be very surprising and perhaps quite inspiring as a future direction of research as we move forward. So can you talk a little bit about mixed courts and sort of what are these different models that are being used in the Qing and in Japan? And was this surprising to you to see this distinction?
Well, first of all, a mixed court is either an ad hoc court or a fixed court with a fixed place where you would try cases involving people or subjects from more than one jurisdiction. So the mixed court in Shanghai was set up in the 1860s, primarily to try Chinese residents of Shanghai that had committed crimes against foreigners or committed crimes that were of interest to the foreign community, and also to try foreigners that were not represented by any treaty or any treaty power. And since Shanghai became a majority Chinese city by the 1850s, 1860s, this became the major court. You know, to go to court in Shanghai in the international settlement, if you were Chinese, was to go to the mixed court. That was more or less the major court. And the consular court, the supreme court that was set up in conjunction with this, was only concerned when British were prosecuted for crime or had to enter into civil suits. And when the British started to negotiate this idea of a mixed court, of course, they had their own idea, which they had brought with them from commercial courts and from a type of court that the French had called the Tijara, the commercial courts in North Africa and also in the Ottoman Empire. The Chinese, when they sort of were faced with these requests, they thought of a mixed court in the sense that you would have in the Chinese case with two equal judges, more or less, sitting in together, deciding the merits of the case and deciding on the punishments. Of course, the foreigners were never willing to cede jurisdiction of a foreigner to a Chinese official, so it was a kind of a halfway solution. The mixed court in Shanghai became a mixed court only as so far as it could prosecute people of Chinese origin but never foreigners, and the Chinese unsuccessfully tried to transform the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom in Shanghai into kind of a counterpart where they could do the same to British subjects as Britons did in the mixed court in Shanghai. And in the case of Japan, they were, of course, watching this when the first Japanese came to Shanghai in the 1860s. They witnessed these institutions, and for them, China was a kind of a laboratory case of what they did not want to be. They very quickly opted for, you know, wanting to conclude treaties with China on the model of the British and the French and the Germans. But the Chinese prevailed, and in the treaty that China and Japan concludes in 1871, the mixed courts that are enshrined in the treaties are equal mixed courts, if you want to put it that way. It meant that Chinese and Japanese, when they were involved in criminal suits, would be tried by Chinese and Japanese officials in conjunction. And this, of course, runs totally against the Japanese idea of exercising sort of exclusive territorial jurisdiction within its own territory. So the Chinese model was off the table, you know, even though they had to accept it under treaty after 1871. But the Japanese started to think, like, how do we make the Americans, British, the French, the Prussians sort of agree to treat the revision? And one kind of model of a different form of mixed court they found in Egypt, which was, of course, the same mixed court that Westerners had been thinking about initially. And they were much more limited in scope. They mainly tried civil suits and certain commercial cases. The Egyptians themselves were not particularly happy with these courts, the way they operated, and actually told the Japanese, if I'm not mistaken, that you shouldn't emulate our model either, because what it means is that you will give the foreigners a foothold in your legal system. It will be very hard to get rid of the foreigners later. And later in the 1880s, when some Japanese legal reformers are tentatively suggesting that perhaps we should have foreign co-judges in our courts, perhaps we should emulate the Egyptian model of mixed commercial courts, it creates an outcry, because the press and also the movement for civil rights in Japan and citizens' rights is in full force. They're demanding a parliament and so on and so forth. This is completely sort of unthinkable. So what is interesting here is that for the Japanese, they are in trying to cope and understand what they have been sort of forced to sign in the 1850s, for them it's natural not to go to China. It's natural for them to go to the other European colonies, and in some way they sort of identify with the colonial powers. And their experience, both with China and also with what they saw in Egypt, was that mixed court is not the way to go, and any form of foreign voice in the Japanese court was not to be permitted, and that was more or less the consensus in the 1880s. And the reason I stumbled on this was actually because of a colleague in graduate school, Jamila Dean, who wrote a book about Pan-Asianism. And he pointed me to these articles. I think there is still more to be found there.
Thank you so much. Now, before we bring this to a close and I sort of ask you some closing questions, I don't want to keep you for too much longer. So what I'll do is just mention a few things for listeners and then ask you to talk about something briefly that's in one of the final chapters. So for listeners, the next chapter switches its focus to Japan. And looks at sort of, again, takes a comparative approach to understanding treaties by comparing a set of extraterritorial arrangements in different sorts of treaties, arrangements that Japan made with Western powers and with the Qing respectively. It sort of mentions the importance of the distinction in how many Chinese were in Japan at this time, which is vast numbers compared to how many Japanese were in China prior to 1895. Then there's a really wonderful chapter, Executing Extraterritoriality, which analyzes a series of criminal cases in China and Japan that were prosecuted. And these include homicide cases, but they also include cases like counterfeiting Japanese paper money, cases involving opium, cases involving whether Nagasaki police could enter the homes of foreigners. And it's, again, really, really interesting stuff. Okay, so because I would love to keep you for another hour and ask you all kinds of things, but in order to respect your time, what I want to ask you to talk a little bit about before we sort of start to bring this to a close is something that happens in the final chapter. In chapter 6, or the final one before the conclusion. Now, this is a chapter that looks at the ways that legal pluralism and extraterritoriality contributed to shaping the public debate in China and Japan in the last decades of the 19th century. But one of the notable things here that you mention is the importance of the year 1895 as a watershed year. Okay, this was not just because 1895 was the year of the abolition of Chinese extraterritoriality in Japan, but also, importantly, and this sort of moves us forward into what might be a really interesting other future research direction, this was also the year of Japan's acquisition of Taiwan. And you make a point here that this is actually really interesting for the history of legal pluralism and Japan, because although Japan at this point abolishes legal pluralism internally, it creates a legally pluralistic regime under colonial conditions. So can you talk about that a little bit? Because that seems both very important for the study, that for your study, but also very important in reminding us that where we find Japan and what we think of as relevant to law in Japan does not just exist under current nation-state boundaries as we understand them today. So would you talk about that a little bit?
I mean, first of all, I think this is a very good question. I'm happy that you asked it. And first of all, one of the points I try to make, I think both initially in my book and also in the conclusion, is that China is, in a sense, both a colonizing power and a colonial power, at least in terms of its Western territories, and is an empire and wants to be an empire. And on the other hand, it's also on its literal frontier a colonized power. It's actually subjected to Western forms of colonialism. And one inherent part, of course, of colonialism in any form or imperial rule is to figure out, I mean, how to pay taxes, how do you levy taxes, how do you measure land, what is legal title to land, and who holds it, and how can it be transferred, and how do you resolve disputes in the community that you're ruling over, how do these people understand crime, you know, what type of punishments are they used for, And all these, of course, are integral to the technologies of imperialism, because most imperial powers realize that if you just go in and, you know, steamroll your own system, it's never going to work. So they, and this is really in this connection that you get legal anthropology starting, you know, legal anthropology that invented the very term legal pluralism, rechtspluralismus in Dutch, I think, in Indonesia. And what the Japanese do in 1895 is going from a position where they have to adapt to the West, whether they like it or not, in order to preserve their national sovereignty. They go from that position, a semi-colonial state, to becoming a colonizing state. And in so doing, they will have to start to get interested in Chinese law. Like prior to 1895, Chinese law is only really interesting to, you know, sinologists or historians. It's not really something that has any political connotations for the political debate in Japan. After 1895, of course, they will have to do all the states, all the things that the Qing states attempted to do in Taiwan. And they will try to do it better. So what do they do? They will have to collect legal materials, they will have to collect archives, they will have to interview people in villages and in communities, what their customs are, and kind of create, I mean, I'm very emphatic here, they have to create a customary law in the sense that they create a snapshot of what they find through their informers and to make that into a colonial regime. And then, of course, most legal pluralist system has the kind of the end game of most legal plural regime is unity, is to go from accepting local laws and custom and then to go towards unification. And one product of that effort is that the Japanese produced manuals. Anthropologists and sociologists created manuals of Chinese customs in Taiwan. Some of the best archives, local archives, that we have from the Qing dynasty are a consequence of these endeavors to chart Taiwan, sort of both temporally and spatially, and for similar reasons. One of the reasons why we have local archives surviving in northeast China, former Manchuria, is of course the colonial state of Manchukuo. So the existence of the archive itself is a product of colonialism, and. This is yet another direction of thinking about legal pluralism and thinking on how the Japanese apply that in Taiwan and in other colonial territories.
Well, Per, thank you so much for talking with us today. Now, there's a lot in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, even though I've really enjoyed talking with you about this so far. Is there anything in particular about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention or point out for listeners who may not yet have had the opportunity to read it?
I think one of the most interesting things to research and to think about was the cases in Shanghai and in Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of making international history local. I mean, these are not really high stakes cases, except perhaps the riot in Nagasaki with Chinese sailors or Qing sailors fighting with local inhabitants. But these are kind of international law in a local context. It's international law where all of a sudden, you know, long term residents of Nagasaki and Shanghai. Would claim to be experts on international law, and it's kind of a state of affairs where you have this almost this British notion of the amateur that you have all these state proclaimed experts on what should be Chinese law, what should be consular jurisdiction, and how Japan should be. And had I had time and I could have written another two chapters about this, there are a number of disputes, a number of interesting everyday events where you cannot only chart, you know, legal customs and social mores, but, you know, get much closer to life in Japan. And in researching, especially Shanghai, I was really helped by this historical atlas that a Japanese a scholar, I think he's a professor of literature in Tokyo. He produced and showing you what houses exist now and what houses have gone. So I actually tried to go to each of these places.
Wow.
See, I went to that department store, you know, where the mixed reports used to be, and I stared at it. I went to one of the crime scenes and realized that the lane is gone, you know, but at least I tried. So kind of exploratory sense, you know, that and I tried to, I put a little bit of that in the footnotes for those who like those kind of details, exactly where is this place and how does it relate to another spot. So I would strongly suggest rereading that chapter.
Great. So now that the book is out, and again, congratulations, what's next for you? What are there any projects that are particularly inspiring you right now?
I'm kind of this mode now, you know, when you're fearing reviewers and looking through your book and see there's anything amiss. But in general, I'm happy and pleased with the book. I have like two projects on top of my head. One is to explore the concept of political loyalty. In my first chapter, I state that the idea of the ordinary subject standing in any kind of ritual obligation to the state was very relatively weak in China, and the idea of sovereignty as strong, as we would say, was not really present in the sense that we would think of it today with loyal subjects. And I discovered a number of normative documents, such as the Sacred Edict, that intersperse actually legal cases, which is what I like to read, intersperse legal cases and codes to show, you know, if you don't abide by this norm, this is what happens. But none of these norms that they tell people to obey talk about the emperor. The only time where the emperor actually enters into the narrative is when he is the big teacher of Confucianism. So that is something that I'm working on at current. The second thing is, I want to study more treaty ports. I want to discover more archives. I already have been to another treaty port, been charting some territory, and now that the North China Herald has been put online, where you can do full text searches, you know, the sky is the limit. So political loyalty, and then to continue with treaty ports.
Well, great. Well, thank you again so much, Per. It's been a pleasure. The book is fantastic. It's given me a lot to think about, and it was really generous of you to take the time to talk with me about it today. So thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll see you next time.